Jennifer Isabella.
And I'm Srividya Sridharan.
Your co-host for Forrester's podcast, What It Means, where we explore the latest market dynamics impacting executives and their customers. Today, we're joined by Vice President and Principal Analyst Jay Pattasol and Principal Analyst Lisa Gately to discuss the state of generative AI adoption among marketers and how they can progress from pilot projects to proficiency. Welcome both.
Thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thanks.
So unsurprisingly, generative AI is a common topic on this podcast. And we've recently had an episode both about the impact of generative AI on agencies and how it might change B2B marketing. So let's talk about where marketers are, right, with Gen AI right now. What are you both hearing?
As you all know, and as I'm sure all of our listeners are aware of, with the launch of ChatGPT in November of 22, by January of 23, all anybody could really talk about in marketing was generative AI. I mean, it was really, really exciting. And for me personally, it was also exciting because the creative roadblock that existed before, which is to say that creators and marketers that were a little bit suspicious of AI were suddenly very open-minded towards it. It was a big unlock. And people were really excited. So we started measuring this with some research in Q1 of 2023. And we discovered that about 19 or 20% of marketers had started incorporating generative AI into their marketing executions. And this was things like content development and copy and a little bit of SEO, kind of very, basic stuff as they started to figure out how that they could apply generative AI to marketing execution. So we measured it again in Q2, and it jumped from 19% to 56%. And we were just, we were excited. We were elated to watch such a huge jump, happen in terms of interest and involvement. But then something happened in Q4. And when we measured it again, it dropped to 26%. Now, we weren't totally surprised by a drop, but as Lisa and I were talking about this, as we were well into our research at that point in time, what we felt like this represented was the realities or the complexities and the practicalities of adopting generative AI had really caught hold to the marketplace. And those marketers and those marketing organizations that had been experimenting and applying generative AI in very basic use cases, we're discovering that it's not as simple as just generating copy. It's not just as simple as 10 people with a license with an AI platform to see where they could produce content or how they could contribute to the marketing execution process. And our research really illustrated that the honeymoon was kind of over, and that the complexity and the hard work of adoption had started. And what Lisa and I found was that this wasn't necessarily a B2C marketing problem or a B2B marketing problem. It was just a marketing issue across the board. And we came across a number of barriers that were getting in the way of adoption.
And just to build on that, Jay, what we also marveled at, we noticed this in all of our conversations with marketers so many times, that leap you described from really curious individuals or pockets of teams, it's hard at an organization level because not all organizations are in the same starting place. You also notice across some of the organizations we work with, there's different readiness in different parts of an organization, just in doing some regular marketing activities, let alone starting to infuse generative AI into workflows. So there are correlations back to what we were noticing in other areas, whether it was trying to discern people's starting levels of AI literacy And overcoming the myth, as basic as content or generation sounds, there's actually a lot to it if you use the content or creative lens in looking at what marketers can do.
So sounds like reality has set in. There's hard work ahead, a lot of hard work ahead when it comes to, collaboration, alignment internally, the data. What are some of those roadblocks that you're seeing holding marketers back from that acceleration?
I think one of the roadblocks that we saw was efficiency as the only business case. And it's definitely the first benefit that you can discover when starting to apply AI and generative AI. You're going to become a little bit more efficient because you're doing things faster. You're speeding up the process. You're generating copy very quickly. You're producing and surfacing images very quickly. You can use the technology to draft ideas and draft kind of first iterations or first concepts. You can fill up a blank page, really quickly. You can produce a long list of branded or unbranded search terms. You can summarize information. All these things were like speeding things up and creating a great deal of efficiency. But that efficiency focused, primarily on reducing labor costs and reducing fees. And what that does is get in the way of advancing into more sophisticated use cases. So the thing that we learned was that prioritizing improving marketing performance was just as important as the efficiencies. And it was one of those things that could help marketers, stair step up to a new set of benefits. And so, what we would recommend is that they look at not only productivity as an opportunity, but also performance and improving how the marketing does in the marketplace and performs in the marketplace, and that takes you kind of to a new set of use cases and definitely a new set of benefits.
I'll start with the second one then. So if you talk about the lens of AI literacy, we've heard that phrase a lot during the past year, especially, but it's very needed. We've really found also in our discussions with different types of marketers, people are still figuring out how this works. And at the broadest level, we know marketers have been using AI for years. It's been in things like advertising, content recommendations, lead scoring, those types of things that are well part of what we do. But when you talk to marketers, how to apply generative AI, how to think bigger beyond those basic use cases, that's where a lot of marketers are stopping. And it really halts the conversation in being able to sort out what generative AI or AI can do versus what the humans will do. So really being able to have a vision or propose what to test out, it starts before people jump to tool talk. Before you jump to the technology or the new capability, you really need to do some learning, and it's across your whole team so that people could see what is possible and first understanding that.
That's such a great point, Lisa. And the learning isn't just the marketing team. I mean, the learning, one of the barriers is the learning out in the rest of the world, including the regulatory environment, which is moving quite slow compared to the pace of technology and the pace of marketing and certainly the pace of culture. So companies aren't sure, what to do. And so, consequently, they've got to educate themselves and not only build the literacy that Lisa was talking about, but understand the ethical and the responsible principles with which to use AI and generative AI in lieu of any regulation or any meaningful laws that would govern it at this point in time.
That's a lot for the marketers to do. And so when we talk to a lot of conversations, you're really left on your own. There are different stats about unapproved tool use. This really is a whole new environment with a lot of curious team members. Of course, people are experimenting and thinking about what they could do. It really leaves a lot for marketing leaders to shine a light on some of this first and talk about what's the perspective, what are the right areas where you could have some impact, and get their arms around it we talk to a lot of marketers where there's a mismatch between different parts of the organization. If there is not some guiding policy, many marketers are making best friends with IT and legal, but it's also becoming more apparent that marketers are going to have more discussions just amongst themselves about what's a potential path to this before people run out. It's very easy with some point solutions, for example, but do they understand, as you said, the responsibility? You own what you are coming up with these outputs and you're responsible. So you really have to think about what this will do for your brand, what you are doing for your audience, and whether there's good impact there. It also leads to a lot of things in terms of, as you look at accepting in this current environment, so many fast changing features and capabilities are available. So I talk to a lot of marketers who will say it's overwhelming to keep up with right now. You almost accept that across your organization, there are different capabilities in the technology you already have. It may be your counterparts in sales or people in other parts of the business also have those capabilities. And everybody works on content, for example. So you're specifying what to use, when, and where. So you have the horizontal view of what a lot of companies will give their employees to use. And then your marketing team, what technologies you have, and whether you really, you've got the vision, you're going to go out there and look at some other solutions that may be more purpose-built. That's a lot to calculate and keep track of as a leader.
Yeah. And especially employees, you know, employees, the rogue use of tools from employees is born out of partly, you know, their interest and their curiosity and their desire to want to be better and to be more proficient. But it's also, you know, slightly born out of their fears and their concerns, which I think is, you know, a major barrier, you know, to your question, Sri, is employee fear, employee security. And it really comes down to just the societal narrative of automation, which is the machines are coming for your jobs, right? They're, you know, the rise of the machines, it's Terminator, but it's really not Terminator. It's WALL-E, right? It's not destructive technology that's taking jobs. It's helpful assistant technology like that of, you know, Pixar's WALL-E, which depicted this robot that was this really, you know, sweet, cute, you know, generous, helpful technology. And that's, you know, and so it's really about helping to assuage employees' fears and concerns about automation by setting the pace and setting the vision for augmentation and, you know, and enhancement. You know, so that's what we suggest to marketers. And those are, you know, those are pretty significant barriers, you know, to overcome, which I think illustrates and underscores why the hard work of adoption has set in.
So in your report, you talk about, first of all, if you need to know where to get to, you need to know where you're starting. So clearly understanding your current level of maturity is an important thing. Talk to us a little bit about what you've uncovered just in terms of the maturity, the current state of maturity as it pertains to GenAI adoption.
Yeah, this was a fascinating exercise, both from our data and then doing some interviews. We broke it down into several segments that we talk about. And I'll talk about this where we'll go from advanced or sophisticated in descending order. We talk about this group that we called the integrators. And those are marketers who've already embedded generative AI into their go-to-market strategies, into their workflows. It's in production. We found that by and large, marketers who are at that point, they have been looking at this for years. Some of those foundational things, and I'm talking about, we were talking some of the world's leading agencies. I was talking with a marketer yesterday who their company made big strides in their data, their technologies, their processes, even before the launch of ChatGPT. They've been at it for years. They would tell you this has been almost a decade in the making in terms of some of their efforts. So those foundational, call it readiness elements, were there when they started to look at what they would use, how they would use it. It also became really clear that they had to grow some in-house experts. So they really committed budget, development, all of the types of roles to help make this happen.
Yeah, we uncovered these segments because, you know, like you said, no company really starts this at the same place. I mean, they you know, you've got different levels of maturity, you've got different levels of expertise, you've got different categories. And so, you know, companies kind of start where they are. And another group, really, I think a large group that we uncovered in this research are explorers. You know, the companies that are piloting Gen AI products and projects, and products, probably a little bit of both, but definitely projects. To help kind of establish their capabilities and to establish their practices. And, you know, we found, the statistics and the percentages, you know, kind of vary depending upon what time of year or when you you ask the question. But there are a lot of companies that find themselves in this grouping of exploration and experimenting. In fact, if reflect back on the story that we started with, there were a lot of marketers that kind of thought that they were, they were exploring, but kind of thought of it as full-on adoption. And I think what they found was that it was really just, you know, forms of experimentation and exploration. So, you know, they're taking a team of hand raisers, those that are most interested in pursuing and understanding generative AI capabilities, and, you know, testing out use cases to see what, you know, what type of outputs that they can produce, you know, which channels, which deliverables, what type of content. We tend to see a lot of this being text oriented, you know, text to text activities. Images and imagery, for a host of reasons, tend to be more complicated. And the least of those reasons would be the concern for copyright infringement from the images that are generated. So experimenters and explorers early on are focusing around copy, and that seems to make a great deal of sense. And so, you know, they can advance by starting to add in some of the performance use cases that are things like analyzing code for media reporting, or insights and data summarization, localizing the content, or translating content into different languages for different marketplaces. These types of use cases, you know, kind of move out of the basic experimentation and help explorers become, you know, look a lot like more like integrators by implementing some more advanced use cases.
Yeah, and it continues. We saw a group that we'll call the considerers. And as the name suggests, we know there are a lot of organizations for a variety of reasons. They have not gotten into the pilot projects. They've not started. They've caught on. I think this is the year where some things will turn. They're starting to look at what do we need to do to get ready? How do we identify our most impactful use cases? And looking at that, those types of considerers, I think for now, what they are starting to see is, look, we've waited. Look at all the multimodal capabilities that are coming. Look at all the types of options others have pursued. They're waiting to learn and crowdsource some ideas, perhaps, but good for them in getting through in terms of the readiness of assessing their data, their technology, their skills, content maturity, and being able to focus, start somewhere. And we talk about starting small and building from some quick wins.
And last but not least, there are marketers that really aren't able or interested to engage with generative AI. I think this is a relatively small group. At any point in time that we have measured this through surveys, they are, you know, single percentage in terms of their size. But it's companies that may find themselves in categories that are highly risk adverse and simply do not want to take on the liability or the burden of introducing a technology that could misrepresent prices in the marketplace, that could misrepresent customer information in some capacity. In some instances, we run into organizations where their IT department simply won't clear or authorize the use of the technology for these reasons of risk aversion. So these rejectors, if you will, of generative AI can take advantage of it through partnerships, you know, and essentially hiring partners that can use the technology on their behalf for marketing content development and other marketing activities, provided that they will indemnify them in doing so. And you know, so even a group that is not able to fully you know, utilize the technology can still benefit from it and learn from that, and hopefully over time advance and mature themselves into that considerer group that Lisa just described.
So leaders, companies understand where they are in this maturity model, right? And now they're making the conscious decision, okay, we want to move forward. We want to adopt generative AI. What are you recommending in terms of how to structure that adoption of the technology or technologies? I know it's a leading question, right? Because I know you guys have built out a framework here, but I think it's really helpful that this should not be a game of whack-a-mole or an acts of randomness, right? There should be a process and steps that leaders should be, you know, leading their teams through.
Yes. We felt that, you know, developing a framework for this really gives a repeatable approach. It gives you something to stand up across teams, because one thing we saw was the need for cross-functional collaboration, having some kind of unified vision rather than, as you said, the whack-a-mole or fragmented approaches across an organization would actually slow things down, or it wouldn't produce the results that they'd intend. So I'll start. We had a three-part framework that we uncovered, and it really gets into, first, establishing this, what is your objective? What you are going to do with the adoption? It comes back around to what your company, what your team is going to accomplish. A few people said this really well, and it's, you're not using generative AI for the sake of the technology. You've really got to be strategic and looking at some of the problems you're trying to solve. A lot of people will go around and quantify the value. We talked to some marketers who really had this exercise. Others would look at proposals or use case view. So either way is fine. If you're trying to look at and prioritize almost into a roadmap, what are the things that you are going to go after? You're going to be very purposeful and look at the value of doing this. We also talk about at this early stage with your objectives, getting your leadership on board. And what we mean by that is, for sure, having some type of executive sponsorship. Over and over again, we found that some of those early adopters who've been able to break through the earliest stages, they had the CMO, they had some connections to the leadership team. So that gave them support in terms of legitimizing these projects, in terms of shining a light on where maybe there had been unapproved tool use or scattered projects, really trying to unify that and come around to a vision. It was also really important then, as you're getting some introductions, if the rest of the company was making some plans, you hear a lot right now about how do you bring marketing to the table, or if marketing is leading this, how do you get the rest of the organization on board? If you, the marketers, you're stewards of the brand, what you want to have in front of your customers and the marketplace, if there's a way to unify that type of effort, get there faster together rather than everybody doing their own exercise.
I think the spirit behind this this framework is really change management. You know, the technology isn't necessarily the complicating part of it. What I think Lisa and I found was that getting people to embrace it and it's always, right? It's always the issue. Getting people to embrace it and use it in a correct and responsible and appropriate way is the real task within this, and that's the change management task. And so, you know, after you have you've set the groundwork in step one, as Lisa was describing, the next step is to ramp up experimentation so that you can move beyond experimentation into more permanent action. And And what we found in our research talking with, you know, dozens of companies was that almost all of them had some form of a AI council or a task force that helped move things forward. You know, probably not all that different from our own AI task force and council inside our organization that has helped us accelerate our use of tools and development of tools. And so, you know, codifying experimentation with a group that is responsible to guide it and produce the initial pilot projects and determine their benefits and the results and help the organization advance and leap off of that is step two. Invest in a Gen AI task force and build knowledge and expertise so that that knowledge and expertise can travel across the rest of the organization. So there are a couple of steps involved in this. First, and I mentioned this before, the hand raisers. There are people inside the organization that are really passionate about this, that are really interested in this. Just as inside every organization, you have people that are like, you know, very, very, very creative, you know, and the task is about finding them and kind of setting them loose, so to speak, letting them go and pursue their interests and their curiosity and their passions. So you harness the hand raisers, you know, and these are the ones that are most interested in it. They'll look at it initially as, you know, their second job, their night job. But eventually you want to get them into a position of this to be more about their permanent job. And they do that by organizing and conducting experiments. And that helps to kind of model the types of change in the behavior that you're looking for. And the, you know, that influence of the hand raiser spreads across the rest of the organization where others are like, well, I want to do that too. You know, how do I do that? And so tapping the hand raisers to harness their interest and their expertise is one of the steps in the task force. The next is to institutionalize experimentation, you know, essentially to kind of codify that the organization will test things and learn from that and grow. And so much of that is atmospheric, you know, creating a atmosphere in which people are and employees are not afraid, you know, and not concerned that these experiments will in some capacity reflect negatively on them, and allowing them to kind of feel that they can that they can, you know, safely experiment and safely test and try things and learn, you know, what to do and learn what not to do, you know, as a result of that. Along those lines, you still need the rigor as part of the experimentation, you know, so you need defined points of measurement, you know, what's happening at 30 days, what's happening at 60 days, what's happening at 90 days, what are you able to determine, you know, consistent and thorough readouts of performance and the processes and how it's all coming together. And you just build that in as the way that you work. And that, you know, codifying that as a way to work goes a long way to make this more ingrained in daily work and not just, you know, a night job. And I think the last point to make here is that there needs to be some adaptability within this. You know, it's equal parts rigor and adaptability. And I think the spirit behind adaptability is, you know, in the point that Lisa made earlier, where, you know, things change so quickly in this category. You know, 5 days in November was a phrase that Lisa and I were using in reference to the CEO of OpenAI leaving and returning to the company with having a job offer at Microsoft in between. I mean, it's like that type of, you know, fast-paced volatility. So anything that you learn now may not be the case 6 months from now. And so some adaptability is important.
Okay, so Jay, Lisa, you walked us through an adoption framework. Who's doing this well? Have we come across marketers and marketing organizations that have, you know, put some of this in place already?
We talked with an impressive amount of companies, and we found there are plenty of people who are in doing pieces of this, in short. Everybody is developing in some way, just because partly we knew these were strategic and cultural elements, you know, particularly the attitudes about experimentation, adapting to change. We did find a few who are very public. So we were talking with marketers from VMware, for example. They were recognized in a Marcom Award last year for their work with building their AI council. We also spoke with many agencies who are very impressive in terms of their work, really building out the infrastructure, getting the sponsorship, getting the expertise so that it was really something as a platform and a practice across a lot of their parts of the agency, their properties. What we noticed with some marketers was success in some of the pieces. One of the final areas, as Jay left off with the experimentation, the adaptability, is how do you keep things going? And it's interesting, we're now talking to some marketers where we are starting to see not so much a night job or in addition to your day job kind of arrangement. We're seeing the first wave of some AI roles. So specifically someone in marketing who is looking out for this. More institutionalization of how do we keep this going? It's almost like a playbook for how do we scale across different parts of, especially the large enterprises, but in organization of any size. So I think that we will start to see this is a larger part of some marketers' job. And as more of these teams have gone through in looking at this experiment, they're really going to identify how do we streamline our workflows? How is this embedded in some of the things that we are doing? We talk about that loosely, but in reality, we know that's going to change the way that people work and they start to spend their time differently. So some of the marketers we spoke with were talking about there's a different approach to a launch, or they would name certain activities that marketers are used to. And they would talk about not just the time savings, but what was the real difference, whether it's for customers or for different audience members. That was where we started to know when people were looking at all different ways of measuring what impact did this have for the business? And then for the marketer, what were the other things that you're able to do?
I feel like exciting times is maybe the understatement of the century right now, but it's incredible what will happen in the next 6, 12, 24 months in this space. Lisa, I know you're going to be on stage at B2B Summit North America diving into this topic. So more to come, I'm sure, from you both and a number of other analysts at Forrester here. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
If you like what you heard today, check out our agenda for Forrester's B2B Summit North America, which includes over 100 analyst-led sessions filled with insights to drive your B2B marketing, sales, and product success. Learn more at forr.com/summit24. That's forr.com/summit24. Thanks for listening.